Support for Science Friday comes from QuickBooks. If you work for yourself, try the new QuickBooks Self-Employed. It helps separate your personal and business expenses so you can quickly track what you spend for work and what you spend for yourself. Try QuickBooks Self-Employed and save up to 50% at tryselfemployed.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Baker's yeast and E. coli are the workhorses of modern-day biology labs. We've engineered them to create all kinds of stuff for us. But why stop there? Why not tinker with some of the other billions of microbes thought to exist on the planet? Bugs that thrive in salty lakes, in the snow, or underground? Who knows? They might have just the genes we need to make next-generation materials and medicines. Great idea. Wish you had thought of it. Well, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is already one step ahead on that one. The deputy director of their Biological Technologies Office, Alicia Jackson, is here in our New York studios to share a few secrets, we hope, about DARPA's biological ambitions. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Why biology? Well, you know, we've seen robots, things like that.
Sure. So when most people think about advanced technology, they'll think about things like you just said, robotics or hypersonic vehicles, Internet of Things. But when you look at what biology can do things that no other man-made technology or chemistry can do, right? It can replicate, it can scale from one to millions to billions in hours, it can adapt. It's programmable through its genetic code. No other technology that we know of can do these things.
So you're just engineering other stuff. You're engineering the microbes.
Biology is technology from our point of view. And if we can program biological systems like we program computers, we might be able to harness, like you said, those secrets of biology.
So what's on your to-do list then? What would you like to make?
Using microbes, what would we like to make? Yeah. We'd like to make plastics that won't melt if they heat up. So you could imagine making metal parts instead out of the metals that we have today, out of plastics. So you could have incredibly lightweight aircraft. Mm-hmm. You could think about making wires that stretch. So could you imagine having conductive wires that you could actually stretch and wrap around so you could truly just roll up your phone or fold it in half?
Mm-hmm. And do you have to find new microbes to do these things, or do you have some in mind already? Do you have to search for the right microbes?
Sometimes you do, because sometimes the microbes that we have right now, like you said before, just don't have the blueprints already to make those interesting materials that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. How would you compete with the whole new world of nanoparticles? Are you in competition with them, or can you make a hybrid of the two?
I think that we're in close collaboration with them, because the key thing that's been missing from nanotechnology is the ability to assemble those nanoparticles up in a controllable way. But biology does this naturally. It naturally handles materials at the nanoscale to build them up into bulk materials.
Mm-hmm. So are we just at the beginning of this whole era of using the microbes, or are we halfway through?
We're just at the beginning, but there's so much we can accomplish already. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm. We saw with the Ebola crisis that it's impractical to try to manufacture antibodies. It's just too slow, right?
Correct.
And you're interested in an alternative. Tell us about that.
We're interested in something called gene-encoded antibodies. So instead of just giving you a protective antibody straight, the protein itself, what we want to do is encode the blueprint for that antibody in DNA or RNA. And the magic about DNA or RNA is that all the cells in your body can read that. So if we give you that blueprint, your cells in your body can read that code and generate the antibodies itself. And we can give you immunity within hours against any infectious disease.
How do you do that? Tell me how you do that.
Well, first what we need to do is find somebody who's recovering from the disease, because floating through their veins is liquid gold, are those protective antibodies. Mm-hmm. Then what we do is we sort through their blood and find the most effective antibody that they have. And then using new computational tools that we have, we basically figure out what the blueprint for RNA or DNA should be. And the best part of all of this is that you can chemically synthesize DNA or RNA. So unlike if you make a traditional antibody, you don't have to use another biological system. So it's very cheap, it's very fast, and it doesn't require any sort of cold chain. And if we can just give you a shot in the arm of that RNA or DNA.
So you have to find the microbes that will make the RNA and DNA in large quantities for us?
Need to use a microbe. We have chemical synthesis mechanisms.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. What kind of new technologies do you need? I'm going to give you a blank check. Giving DARPA a blank check. It's like an oxymoron. But I'm going to give you a blank check. What kind of things don't you have that you would like to see? Some magic machine or something?
Sure.
That you'd like to have?
There's two critical things missing from biotechnology today. And you find them everywhere else in every other high-tech industry. Number one is a large amount of computer scientists and data analytics. Biology is a big data problem, but we haven't brought a lot of the tools that we're using in other fields, especially for example, all the apps that you have and things like that, to bear in biology. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is automation. You still go into a bio lab today, you'll find incredibly sophisticated, highly trained postdocs pipetting colorless liquids around by hand. That's mm-hmm. crazy. These folks should be thinking about, you know, genius ideas that they can implement, not pipetting things around by hand. There should be machines to do this.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk with Dr. Jackson. Alicia Jackson is here in our studios talking about DARPA's biological ambitions. How old is this program? When did this program start, your biological program?
We call it Living Foundries, mm-hmm. and that started about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the biotech office at DARPA has only been around for a little over a year.
Is it late to the game? I mean, why did you start it 4 years ago why only a year and a half ago?
That we started the office?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a new way of looking at biology. It's not your traditional biomedical sciences, fundamental exploratory type of science office that you might find at, for example, the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. The thing that's unique about this is we're for the first time at a point where we can start to think about using biology to build capabilities, to actually have impact.
Well, speaking of the NSF, what can you do that they can't do that we need to have you do it?
Sure. So what NSF is very good is for kind of going across the research community and looking at what's bubbling and seeding lots of interesting ideas. What DARPA is great at is we go harvest the ideas that are ready for prime time, that we can actually go build a new technological capability off of. So we kind of harvest those and then drive them into a product.
Hmm. One of the areas you're interested in is making us good use of all the open source stuff.
Yes.
That's out there. There's a lot of open source stuff. How would we make better use of it?
For biology.
Yeah. How do you get more bang for your buck?
Absolutely. One of the things we'd love to see more of is publishing of data and making it open to everyone. For example, clinical trial data would be incredibly useful for folks to be able to sort through to draw interesting conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 844-724-8255. Let's go to Ray in Modesto, California. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I was reading in Popular Science this year, Stanford studying a new bug that lives and eats electricity and generates like a nanotube that's conductive. Has DARPA looked into anything like that?
What you're talking about is microbial fuel cells, and these are super interesting, but it's unclear whether they're going to be cost competitive anytime soon, especially, you know, earlier we were just hearing about Elon Musk's new giant battery factory that's out there. So I think it's super interesting, not clear it's ready for implementation.
These are bacteria that make electricity?
Correct.
Because I remember years ago, we had a scientist from the Naval Office, Naval Research Lab, right near where you guys are, on the Potomac, and they had discovered a bacteria in the mud in the Potomac.
Yes.
And it was very funny because the next week after that, we got a call from the Secretary of the Navy to talk about that. And so we talk a lot about the human biome, the microbiome, the biome that's in the soil, there's a biome in people. This is like untouched, untapped territory, isn't it?
It's totally untouched. And there's not only the microbiome, but there's something even more interesting called the virome.
The virome,
which is even larger. There's all this amazing capability out there ready for us to go harvest it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're set up to do is to work on this, to
Absolutely.
Harvest this stuff?
Yes.
How many scientists do you think in the world, or let's talk about the U.S., are working on this kind of thing right now? Are they thousands, hundreds?
Probably thousands right now. Mm-hmm. But we need way more, and we need people from other fields, not just biology, who can come bring a different perspective to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking to recruit scientists?
Yes, we are, very actively. Either to come to DARPA and build new programs or to come work with us to build new technologies.
Do you think that people are sort of scared to go work for defense? Anything that starts with the word defense on it?
I think until they meet us, some people have some hesitation.
You're as geeky as the rest of us. How did you get involved in this? What's your background?
I have a very unconventional background. I did my PhD at MIT in nanotechnology and quickly decided I did not want to spend the rest of my life in the lab.
Right.
So I took a jump and went into science policy and worked for Senator Jeff Bingaman, who at the time was the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee. One of the best experiences I've ever had. And the thing that I got out of that was a real national perspective. How do we put in place good science and technology policy that's going to move the nation forward? Mm-hmm. I got a little fed up with the politics. Policy was great. And then I decided that at DARPA, I could bring this national perspective together with the ability to actually drive real technological change. And that's a very unique thing to have access to.
So you really think you're making a difference?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every day.
Yeah. But how long can you be doing this for?
That's the interesting thing about DARPA. We only can stay 3 to 5 years.
They kick you out?
They kick you out. They want fresh ideas constantly coming in. We don't want a big bureaucracy to grow up within the organization. So it keeps things very nimble and it always keeps things a little crazy.
Mm. All right. Well, we expect now that you've been on, we expect big things out of this program. And we thank you very much for sharing the secrets of DARPA with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Jackson. Alyssa Jackson is working for DARPA. She's deputy director of DARPA's Biological Technologies Office in Arlington, Virginia. Good luck to you wherever you go following DARPA. Thanks for being with us today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, how well do you know your emotions? Could a kid's movie help you know them better? We'll talk about this new film, animated film, Pixar's Inside Out. It's really different. We'll talk about why that is. Stay with us. One of the most difficult things to buy is a mattress, right? Lying on a bed for 4 minutes in a showroom is not very convincing. And you can pay a lot of money for that mattress. Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, has a better idea. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings on to you. That's why Casper offers a 100-day risk-free trial and painless return policy. Their mattresses are obsessively engineered, too. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Casper mattresses are made in America and outstandingly priced. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size. And today, you can save an additional $50. Go to casper.com/scifry and insert the promo code SCIFRY. Casper mattresses for better nights and better mornings. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How do you put what's inside a kid's head up on the silver screen? Disney animators tried that way back in 1943 in a short film called Reason and Emotion. In the cartoon, Emotion is a little caveman up in Junior's mind running the show.
Let's go inside Junior's head and watch Emotion at work. Aha, here he is. He's got the whole place to himself. He can do as he pleases.
Animation and psychology have come a long way since the 1940s. Last week, Pixar released Inside Out, a movie that goes inside the brain of an 11-year-old girl named Riley. True to the science, things are a lot more complicated in Riley's head than they were in Junior's 1940s brain. Riley's brain is a control tower manned by 5 emotions.
I'm joy. This is sadness. That's anger.
What?
This is disgust.
Ugh.
And that's fear.
Ah!
We're Riley's emotions. We're what make Riley, Riley.
Ah! Look out!
Get off of me!
How was Inside Out able to accurately put a face on emotion? The filmmakers got some help from my next guest, Dacher Keltner. He's professor of psychology, co-director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. He helped Pixar director Peter Docter navigate the 11-year-old psyche. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Keltner.
It's great to be with you, Ira.
I want to ask our listeners if they've seen Inside Out or they have a question about how emotions work. Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-S-F-R-I. I got to say, I thought this was a groundbreaking movie. I mean, it's just amazing. I know that Disney has a history, as we tried to show, of doing sort of educational movies, but this was fantastic. Is it going to change the way people talk about their emotions?
Well, I think it already has. I mean, I think that it's getting people to think about how emotions guide our memories and our stream of consciousness and what they do in our social lives. So it's already stimulated a pretty incredible conversation.
Oh, yeah? How did you get involved in this?
Well, you know, about 7 years ago, I was at a scientific conference, and believe it or not, Pete Docter, the director of the film, was on a panel with me and Paul Ekman, and we were talking about expression and how do you study it scientifically, and you know, how do artists like Pete get emotional expression in film. And then about 5 years ago, Pete called me up and he said, "Hey, I want to float an idea by you. I want to do a film about emotion and what it does to our minds and how it shapes our lives." And all in an 11-year-old girl. And I was like, well, good luck with that. And since then, it's been this really interesting conversation with Pete Docter's creative team at Pixar.
So over the years, and it took years to make this film, correct?
You
get a phone call 3 o'clock in the morning saying, oh, we're stuck. What do we do now?
Yeah, and it was a little bit more open-ended. You know, they just were taking on really big questions about, you know, what do dreams do to emotions? What does language do to emotion? How many are there? What do they look like? What are they like in the brain? And I'd pop by and talk about science and pass on articles and as part of the conversation.
And you can tell from the quality of the film, the animation, how serious they really were about trying to get it right and trying to convey something educational, even though they probably didn't mean to be educational.
Yeah, I was astonished by what they accomplished. I mean, it is really hard to capture how emotions transform the way we perceive the world, right? What Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher, called the magical transformation of emotions. And I think that the way with the control panel and the emotions grappling with each other in guiding how Riley mm-hmm. looks at the world, I think it really gives people a sense of what emotions do in the mind, which scientists have been grappling with for 40 or 50 years. So I say kudos to them for taking the science really seriously.
We get five main emotions in that control panel. Fear, sadness, joy, disgust, and anger. Are those really the biggies, or are there more that could have been included?
Well, you know, that's a funny story because, you know, there is a good deal of scientific consensus that those are core emotions to human nature, really, that Charles Darwin started writing about and that scientists have been studying for the past 50 years. There's a whole new wave of science on really interesting emotions like awe or embarrassment or amusement or pride. And I actually pitched Pete Docter really early in the movie. I was like, hey, you know, why don't you throw awe in the mind and see what happens? And he's like, look, we can only handle 5 or 6 characters, so perhaps a sequel.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting how they chose islands. In the movie, the emotions are centered on islands. Was that a logical choice, a way to demonstrate? Or, you know, I guess if they had done rooms, we would have said, why rooms?
Yeah.
You know?
And well, I think that would be, you know, they have these 5 islands of Riley's personality, right? Family and friendship and what I love, Goofball Island and Hockey and Honesty Islands. You know, I think some scientists would take issue with that. They would think about, you know, personality traits that are based in our genes and relationship patterns and the like. But I think what was really compelling about that decision of mm-hmm. islands is that, you know, we know, for example, that how you attach to your parents is just a fundamental structure in the human mind. And then it shapes your life. And So hence we have the family island. So, it's an artistic choice. There was other science that could have been considered, but I think it's compelling to people.
Yeah, the way I saw the movie, and I want to play a clip from it now.
Sure.
Anger and sadness play a large role in the film.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to give any spoilers away. So I want to play a scene from the movie. This is when we meet Anger, played by Lewis Black. He was just terrific, his voice in this
hysterical.
Film. I think he steals the film. Now, in this scene, Riley's a toddler, and her dad's trying to get her to eat some broccoli.
Riley, if you don't eat your dinner, you're not going to get any dessert.
Wait, did he just say we couldn't have dessert?
That's Anger. He cares very deeply about things being fair.
So that's how you want to play it, old man? No dessert? Oh, sure. We'll eat our dinner right after you eat this.
That was terrific. Now Anger cares about things being fair. You know, I hadn't thought of Anger that way before.
Yeah, and this is one of these ways in which this film, I think, is going to get people to think about emotions in a really new way. You know, for a long time in Western thought in particular, we thought of emotions as irrational and dysfunctional and disruptive and animalistic and base. And scientists are really moving towards a view that emotions as products of human evolution really help us solve basic problems in our social lives. And anger, even though it kind of is hard in our social lives, it actually helps us protect fairness in social relationships. And there's a really subtle illustration of that in that clip you played. I think it's great.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. And one, as I said before, one of the messages of the movie, of course, is it's okay to be sad. Sad can be used positively.
Yeah. You know, I think that, and I would say fear as well, that, you know, parents in particular, when they see their kids and in our own experience, when we have these, quote, negative emotions, there's a tendency perhaps to think, oh, God, I want this to end. I should shift to another state. And I think that the film says that every emotion, even emotions like fear and sadness, have their function. They have their place. Fear helps us avoid dangers and perils, right? The sadness helps us kind of figure out things that we're losing and how to kind of build upon that. So I think I think it's a really important lesson of the film.
Let me go to the phones. I want to go to Shane in Port Smith, Arkansas. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. I had a question for you. I was wondering which one of the emotions are more closely tied to memory.
Good question. In fact, memory is a big part of this film, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think it's one of the more magical elements of the film about how our memories change as a function of our current emotion. So, you know, what we know from the science of emotion and memory is, first of all, we do remember more emotional events than less emotional events. So all of the emotions help us remember things, right? I think that the second theme with respect to memory is that, and I think it's so dramatically portrayed, whether it's accurate or not is left to be debated. But, you know, our current feelings shape what our past seems like to us. So if you think about a family reunion or a holiday and you're in a current feeling, you're feeling blue or sad, you're going to call forth different elements of that experience than if you're feeling, amused or angry. So I think that the movie tells us that emotions are powerful guides of what we remember.
And we here on Science Friday, we talk a lot about memories. And over the years, we've been learning that every time you take a memory out, look at it and put it back, you don't really put it back the same way you took it out. There's something slightly changed about that memory. And that's sort of in the film, isn't it? And they take out the little globules and they touch them, the emotions touch them, and they put them back, they're a little different.
It is. It's one of the challenging dimensions to human experience, which is that, you know, we would love to have pure memories of our past, but they're always changing with how our feelings change.
And another thing you notice in the film that may be missing in Inside Out, the emotions are in the driver's seat, and there's no reason or logic character, right? It's all emotional.
It is. And, you know, as an emotion scientist, of course, I applaud that decision. But, yeah, absolutely. You know, not only, you know, if you were to purely represent the science, would you have other characters like awe or pride or embarrassment, other emotions. But, you know, clearly, and there's a very robust science on how more deliberative rational processes shape our emotional experience, things like language and metaphor and conversation. And so I think that that could have been built into Riley's mind. But I will say, Ira, you know, there is this emerging sense in the science of emotion that emotions are primary drivers of a lot of big decisions, moral decisions, decisions about risk and the like. So I think in that sense, it takes a stand, which is emotions guide thought, as David Hume long ago thought.
We've had a couple of listeners asking this question, and that is, why was love as an emotion left out?
Yeah. The film? Yeah. Well, I share that sense. I think, first of all, the emotions are tailored to the developmental period of the girl. So Riley's 11. And I think that she does have a lot of affection for her parents, obviously. But I think that if Pixar were to do a film of Riley at age 18, we might see a different cast of emotions in her mind, and love would be one.
Sequel? It'd be very easy to do a sequel on this, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Follow somebody as they get older. Let's go to the phones. Go ahead. While I'm queuing up the phone, tell us what you'd like to say.
Well, no, I mean, it's almost like the 28 up, right? You could do this every seven years and look at what Riley looks like.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you just joined us, we're talking about the new Pixar film. And it is really a great film. I'm talking with Dacher Keltner, who's professor of psychology and co-director of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. And if you haven't seen it, go out and see it. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Marcy in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Marcy.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Have you seen Inside Out?
I have not seen it yet, and I'm dying to. And I'll tell you why. I'm a school counselor. I work with kids, elementary all the way up through 12th grade. And one of the things that I've struggled with when I talk to kids about their emotions, and I use some of the same language that I hear is being used in the film. You know, I talk about anger not being a bad thing, you know, that it's helping us realize that something is really important. And I end up drawing stupid pictures to try to, you know, help kids get a visual because they're very visual. And so I just can't wait for this movie to come out so that I can have a visual reference to kind of show because I just end up talking and younger kids need something more tangible, you know, to reach the different senses in order to understand something. So I'm just so grateful for your guest's work in contributing and to the people, to Pixar for baking it. So, and I can't wait to use it in my work. So thank you.
Thank you. You know, this is maybe a kid's movie, but it's not a kid's movie. You know, as much as Fantasia was a kid's movie, you know, it just crosses all, I think, age boundaries. And you sit there in the film and you hear parents commenting to each other about what they saw, you know, that sort of thing. Do you agree?
I agree. You know, one of the, and we know this scientifically as well, that one of the real challenges of being a parent with young kids is young kids have these combustible emotions and temper tantrums and, you know, powerful passions. And, you know, one of the charges of being a parent is to give your children, or as in Marcy's case, the children you work with in your profession or in schools, a language of emotion, mm-hmm. a set of images, a set of metaphors, right? And we know scientifically that when kids develop really rich languages of emotion, they just do better with peers, they do better in school, they can calm themselves down better. And I think this film is a platform for just that kind of experience.
Now, as you say, Riley's 11 years old. Was that is that age critical? Was that chosen on purpose?
Yeah, you know, it was, Ira. You know, I remember, you know, it was so striking. Pete Docter, the director, you know, we'd have these conversations at Pixar, and then he emailed me quite and read articles and follow-up questions about neurotransmitters and physiology and emotions. And one of his kind of most poignant questions was, what is the emotional life like of an 11-year-old girl, right? And I was taken aback, and so upon consulting the literature, you know, what we know is as girls head into the preteen years, and parents will really identify with this, or women thinking about their past, you know, head 11, 12, 13, it gets really complicated emotionally. And we know that girls' daily positive emotions tend to really regrettably plummet, and they feel more anxiety and social pressure. So I think that was a really critical decision and strategic choice for the film
to take that on. Yeah, without giving anything away, at the end of the movie, Riley gets an expanded emotion console. I guess things are going to get more complex, right, as she gets older. Yeah, Can't wait for this sequel. It's been a great movie. It's a great film. It's Inside Out. It's a new Pixar film. I'm talking with Dacher Keltner, professor of psychology and co-director of the Greater Good Science Center, UC Berkeley in Berkeley, California. He consulted on the new Pixar movie. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you.
It's great being with you, Ira.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about ice cream. Do you like that? We all love ice cream, right? Do you try to make it at home, and something goes wrong? It turns into some, like, sort of a snowball? We're going to talk about how to get it better after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you scream for ice cream? Or is it more like you scream when you've just spent hours mixing up a homemade batch of ice cream and then it melts everywhere or is full of fat globules or has the consistency of a bag filled with crunchy shards of ice? I hate it when that happens. The official start of summer is a good time to learn how to avoid the pitfalls of whipping up your own ice-cold desserts. Jeff Potter, author of the book Cooking for Geeks, is here to help solve your frozen food failure. And if you got any questions about how to mix up the cold stuff, give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. SciFry. To understand how the professionals, let's talk about how the professionals make the cold confection. We send producer Becky Fogel to Ample Hills Creamery in Brooklyn for some hands-on research into ice cream science. She met with owner Brian Smith up on the roof of his shop, and he explained how one essential ingredient can also lead to your ice cream's demise.
The biggest obstacle to smooth and creamy ice cream is water. Water is the number one ingredient in whole milk. It's the number one ingredient in heavy cream. And so we don't want the water in our ice cream to turn icy.
Now, Jeff, you're here with us. Let's talk about ice cream. Let's talk about water, like Brian said. How do you prevent your ice cream from turning into a frozen milk snowball?
Well, it's a good question. There's really two main things to it. It's how you make the ice cream and then what's in the ice cream. So the first bit of that, how you make it, ice crystals are all about nucleation and crystal growth. And so when you look at making ice cream, it's all about trying to keep those ice crystals that are in the base from turning into larger, grittier things. And then the second part of all of this is what's actually in the ice cream, because that actually changes how the mixture sets up when it freezes. Ice cream is one of those amazingly complicated, well, a scientist would call it a complex colloid. You know, it's this strange, bizarre texture in a lot of ways.
And it's got a lot of stuff in it.
It's fundamentally, it's a liquid that actually traps solids in it. So you've got ice crystals and fat globules, mm-hmm. and you also have air in there trapped in that liquid. And as well, that liquid is actually an emulsion. And now, when I say liquid, I mean the actual ice cream in your freezer is technically actually a liquid with ice crystals and fat globules and air bubbles and all this other stuff going on in there. And the ratio of the ingredients and how you make it really determined if it's going to fail or work.
Hmm. So how do you make sure then if water is the most important ingredient, how do you make sure you do that right?
So for handling the water, it's really about interfering with the ice crystals from forming. So when you look at the recipe, that's one part of it. So it'd be fats, the emulsifier, the sugar in there. You know, a good ice cream has got a certain amount of fat in it. It's typically 14 to 22% fat. And if you're looking at a recipe and you're not sure how much fat's in it, there's actually a nice little trick. You can go to Wolfram Alpha and online and just plug in the ingredients. So if you go and take, you know, 2 cups cream plus 1 cup milk plus 3/4 cup sugar, it'll spit out the weight grams, and you can figure from that you're at 16.5% fat. So if you take your recipe, make sure it's about, you know, 14 to 18% fat seems to be pretty standard for home stuff. And then the other bit of it is to actually, you know, if you're at home making ice cream, there's actually a couple of cheats you can do. One is to use eggs because they have lecithin in them, and that lecithin acts as an emulsifier. Mm-hmm. So if you're making an American style or sometimes called Philadelphia style ice cream, it doesn't have the egg, doesn't have the lecithin, doesn't have the stabilizer. So that's the second part of the ingredients. And then the third thing is the amount of sugar in there. And sugar is actually really important because of freezing point depression. So ice cream with sugar in it, you know, has a lower freezing point, and that changes how that three-dimensional structure, that complex colloid, actually sets up in the freezer.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jessica in Santa Rosa, California. Hi there. Welcome to Science Friday, Anne.
Hi there. Yes, well, my question kind of relates to what you just said. I wondered how necessary it is to use eggs. It really makes making ice cream take a lot longer, so is it really that important?
Well, the emulsifier certainly prevents the ice crystals from aggregating up, but there are other things besides egg that can act as an emulsifier. So if you go and you look at commercial ice cream in the store, you'll sometimes see that it'll say things like carrageenan or agar or any other kind of stabilizer. If you're willing to explore, you know, other options besides the egg can be used in there. So xanthan gum is easy to get at the store, about a teaspoon per quart. If you just put it into the blender and blend it up, it'll actually act in a similar way. The other thing that happens with the egg yolk is the egg yolk actually brings a fair amount of fat in there. So, again, trying to do the calculation on how much fat's in your recipe will help.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling. Do you need a special kind of ice cream maker to make it the best? You have these electric ones, you got the hand-churning ones.
Yeah, there's hand-churning ones. You know, there's of course, the geeky approach of using liquid nitrogen, which works really well because it freezes the water really fast, so you get small ice crystals.
Give us a lesson in there.
Liquid nitrogen?
Yeah,
oh.
What do you do with that?
Well, the liquid nitrogen stuff's actually a lot of fun. It's been done for over a century. You basically take your ice cream base, about equal parts ice cream base to liquid nitrogen, you throw it in a bowl. You should know how to handle liquid nitrogen.
It's 300 degrees below
yeah,
zero.
You
got to be careful.
It's cold, but it actually freezes it very quickly, and it gives you really creamy texture, at least initially, because the first bit that happens when you make the ice cream is it comes to what's basically like a soft serve stage. And the second thing that happens is when you put it into your freezer, it sets up into a more solid state. So in soft serve stage, it's about 50% of the water is frozen. At the later stage, it's about 75-80% is frozen. In terms of ice cream makers, you're probably not going to get liquid nitrogen so easily, you know, at your local grocery store.
Yeah. If you're on a university campus, maybe in the chemistry department. Yeah.
Right. Salt and ice, the old traditional churning, is actually a great way of making it. And a lot of people think about the salt and the ice combining, you know, to what they would say is freezing point depression. That's not actually really what's going on there. It's actually an endothermic reaction from the salt actually cooling down as it dissolves. Cools down the surrounding mixture. And then, of course, the ice itself, as it melts, that takes a lot of heat in from the base. So, you know, if you want, salt and ice in the old-fashioned churning actually is a fun summertime project. You know, about 20 or 30 minutes, you can set up some ice cream and, you know, enjoy it. And if you're not worried about ice crystals, you eat it right away. You don't even have to deal with the possibility of not having enough fat or emulsifiers in there.
And if you are worried about the crystals?
If you are worried about the crystals, then you need to make sure that you actually get those fat, sugar, and emulsifier. Emulsifier is not necessary, but certainly it's a cheat. It helps. You have to make sure you get them the right ratio. Another thing is freezing it quickly is important. So not just when you churn it, but when you put it into your freezer. You know, it's not the freezer is not a time machine. It doesn't just stop things. That ice cream has to still set up in the freezer. So set your freezer to as low as possible. Make sure that the container you're using is actually relatively thin and flat as opposed to a kind of a large box, because you need to get that whole thing to freeze up. And if it takes longer, those ice crystals have time to aggregate.
So like a cookie sheet.
Yeah, a cookie sheet or just a baking pan. You know, that actually will work better because you're talking about getting that whole mass to set faster. And the enemy with ice crystals is slow freezes. You want it to set as fast as possible. Another thing, of course, is in your freezer, make sure there's plenty of airflow so that you're not just putting your container, you know, right next to some other stuff and there's no air to circulate against it in your freezer.
Wow. Let's go to the phones to Fort Collins, Colorado. We're going to be in Colorado next week. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
So I have an odd question about making ice cream while backpacking. I was wondering if you have any tips on making ice cream with dehydrated milk and snow and kicking around the ball.
If you've got snow to work with on your hiking, I mean, I'm thinking about a warm summertime day here in New York right now with the idea of doing that without snow. But yeah, if you've got, you know, this is very similar to the kind of standard fun physics or chemistry classroom demo you might do in high school, where you take, you know, a ball or even a plastic bag. If you take that snow and you pack it around whatever your container is that holds your ice cream base, and if you can pack some salt with you, that table salt, when you throw it in that snow mixture, is going to the process of it actually dissolving is going to take a fair amount of heat from the surrounding thing. I actually brought in a little demo of
which we can do if demos. You like.
What I've got here is a cup of water and a quarter cup, 50 grams, of just standard table salt. And they're at the same temperature. And you'll see that the temperature right now, I have not added them together yet. The temperature of that water is 74 degrees.
Right.
And if I dump this in.
Salt, it's dropping.
It's dropping. So what's it saying?
It's down to 70. About 70,
yeah.
Stirring it up.
So you saw almost instantly a 4 or 5 degree Fahrenheit, just instant drop.
And that happens because?
That happens because the salt crystal itself, when the sodium and the chloride ions are splitting apart from that crystal, that takes a certain amount of heat. Now, to be clear, there's another thing going on here. It's not just the dissolving energy. It's also hydration energy. So as the sodium ions start to float around the solution, that actually also does some stuff. So I actually have a second demo here.
Yeah.
Just because, you know.
Guess we're Science Friday.
We're Science Friday. Yeah. And this is calcium chloride. This is the stuff that you'd be sprinkling on your sidewalk out in the middle of winter.
Right. We had a lot of that.
and this stuff. So I'm going to take, I've got a second cup here. I'm going to take that probe thermometer and it should go back up too. You can see it's a little bit warm.
It's up, 73 now, back
73,
up.
Okay. Yeah, here's what happens when you add this stuff. It's a salt. It's a different salt, but it's still a salt. And look what happens to that temperature.
Whoa, it's going up to 83, 91, 103, 116, 121.
It gets hot.
124,
so
that's
this is
salt.
Just to say that when you're making the ice cream, salt is not just, you know, incidental ingredient. If you want to go make ice cream while you're hiking and you got some snow around, some salt's actually going to help you pull off that trick.
And don't confuse those two salts.
No, and I would not eat one of them.
No, sodium chloride. We have a lot of tweets coming in, and they want to know, can you make ice cream from soy or almond milk?
Sure. You still need to make sure that you've got enough fat in there. And if you're trying to make something with soy or almond milk, I'm going to assume that you're trying to go for something that's, shall we say, dairy-free.
They want vegetarian
So if you're going for a vegan ice cream, you still need to get that actual fat in there. But fortunately, nuts have a lot of fat. So from the fat point of view, you're looking for, again, that 14 to 22 is kind of the broader range. So you'd have to mix in some fats of some sort. You know, nuts would be a good source. You'd also need some sugar because that sugar actually does do freezing point depression on the actual ice cream base. But it doesn't matter where the physical and chemical properties come from. It's not like the ice cream knows it's being made, you know, from a structural point of view with milk product. As long as you've got the actual carbs, fats, sugars, proteins kind of in the right ratio and you treat it correctly in terms of the ice crystals, it'll still work.
And we have a caller who says, how do you get the texture, the right texture when you're making, using non-dairy or vegan ice cream? Is there a certain
this one's tougher because at that point you don't necessarily have as much of the stabilizers that are present. So milk itself actually can act as a stabilizer for the emulsion and the liquid stage, the plasma stage of the actual ice cream. So you'll have to still deal with some sort of emulsifier. So if you want to make vegan ice cream, I would suggest seeing if you can use something like agar, karangi, and xanthan gum, any of the products that are actually of vegan source. That'll help kind of give you some insurance that you don't necessarily hit everything exactly right.
Talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, talking about ice cream food failures and how to combat them on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And lots of stuff, because I want to move on, because a lot of people just don't want to make vanilla ice cream, right? They had candy, they got cookie dough, sometimes fruit. Now, when Becky Fogel went out to see Brian Smith over there at the Ample Hills Creamery, she asked him about adding strawberries to your ice cream. What's the best way to do that?
Anything with fruit in it that you want to pulverize or smush up and mush up and turn into a puree is a real challenge because, of course, the number one ingredient in every fruit is water. So when we make strawberry ice cream, one of the tricks that you can do is you macerate the strawberries overnight first, which is to say you take your strawberries and you put a bunch of sugar over top of them, and then you leave them in the fridge overnight, and that sugar draws out the water from the strawberries. It draws out a lot of the water. And now you have your strawberries, which have a lot less water content.
Jeff, how does that sound to you?
That sounds delicious. strawberries are really tricky because they're like 92% water. And water is the enemy. Now, there's another thing going on here with the sugar, is that that fruit, when he macerates it, is actually pulling in sugar. And sugar and water, just like salt and water, has a freezing point depression thing going on. So that fruit will actually set at a lower temperature. So yeah, removing some of the water will certainly help. But the other bit of it is that adding sugar. So when you've got fruits, you usually want about, well, the technical papers say 21% sugar, but I'm just going to say 20%. So if you macerate your fruit in a 3 to 4 parts fruit to 1 part sugar, you'll get something that actually has a lower freezing point that's roughly equal to the same texture as the ice cream.
Interesting. A tweet in from Andy who says, my grocery store has dry ice. Is that good for making ice cream?
If you like your ice cream to be effervescent, you can do some interesting stuff there. As long as it's food grade, you can take powder it up, take a hammer, put it between a couple towels and whack it up until it's, nice and powdered. And if you stir that into something that's more of a, fruit base, sorbet, something like sherbet, something like that, and you don't mind the effervescent flakes, because it's carbon dioxide, and it's going to partly carbonate the actual ice cream, which, maybe that's what you like. It could be interesting.
Because they're even professional ice cream people pump air, right? They pump different to make fluffier ice cream.
This is called overrun. And the home machines and doing this at home is hard to do. The machines that they use commercially actually can inject, it can practically double the volume. If you ever look at light ice cream, the label of light ice cream, usually it's just got more air in it. It doesn't weigh as much. You're just buying expensive air. So the overrun bit is actually an important detail in terms of the commercial stuff. At home, it's a little bit hard to whip that air in. But
Last few words, what's the biggest mistake people make and what should they not do? Is it the temperature?
Biggest mistake is probably not actually setting it up quickly enough. Get it to be cold.
All right, there you go. Thanks for those tips. We were talking about tips for food failures with the guy who knows a lot about science and a lot about cooking, Jeff Potter, author of the book Cooking for Geeks. Welcome back. We'll see you next time.
Thanks so much.
One last thing. People who are cynics and don't trust others tend to earn less money in life. A study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology surveyed thousands of people in the U.S. and Europe about their attitudes and their income. And people with low levels of cynicism earned an average of $300 per month more than the cynics. Why is that? Well, perhaps people who trust one another and cooperate and collaborate, they make more money. Why am I not surprised? BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We also had help today from David Pincus. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video, and point your tablet to or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. Next week, we're going to be in Colorado, and we would love you to come out and be part of our audience. We are going to be at the Aspen Ideas Festival on Tuesday, June 30th, in the evening, to talk neuroscience, math, and more. That'll be about around 8 o'clock at night, a special show, special version of Science Friday. Tickets and more information at sciencefriday.com/Aspen, Aspen, Colorado, next Tuesday evening, June 30th. We hope to see